It'd be a happy Thanksgiving to y'all. I don't know about you, I concur with Mr. Turnblad and Mr. Pischke both. This is one of my favorite times of the year. I mean, not only because, you know, growing up is football and hunting and, you know, just nice, comfortable weather. And, of course, now it's become for us, once you come into the church and understand the truth, it's the secular extension of the most marvelous time of the year, the Feast of Tabernacles, which is a harvest festival, and in many respects, God's harvesting the most important crop in the universe, and we're it, or part of it. And then, of course, later on, we go on to a physical harvest. So, Turnblad, I totally concur. By the way, how many here have ever read George Washington's proclamation, the first Thanksgiving? You ought to go online. I just heard it the other day. I printed it out, and I was going to read it to the kids. We had a little group on Thanksgiving, about 21. It was supposed to be about 25 or 26. Taking my wife to a sanity clinic afterwards, next few days. But little critters running around the house. It's fun. It's a good time. Wonderful time of the year. But anyway, the proclamation is spectacular. A lot of people say George Washington paled in his eloquence compared to guys like Thomas Jefferson of, you know, Declaration of Independence fame, and certainly Abe Lincoln. But you read that, it's moving. It's powerful. So, and by the way, too, Mr. Pischke, I want to concur with you that age is no limit to being an idiot. My wife and I talk about it. We had one year, several here at the feast this year, and just last few days, it seems like, the old idiot syndrome sneaks up and grabs you. And the older you get, you think you figure this stuff out. You know, you've been through this before a few times, you know. So we're constantly figuring out ways, you know, to beat this. You know, little tricks here and there. You know, we put notes on our notes. And then notes on our notes on our notes, so we don't forget stuff. Lay them in the middle of the floor and trip over them. You know, remind us to do this and that. And anyway, but that doesn't take away from Thanksgiving, right? It's a wonderful time of the year. Well, for almost everybody, this gentleman seemed to have a little challenge. Ducking into the confession with a turkey in his arm. Brian said, "Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. I stole this turkey to feed my family. Would you take it and settle my guilt?" "Certainly not," said the priest. "As penance, you must return it to the one whom you stole it." "I tried," Brian sobbed, "but he refused. Oh, Father, what should I do?" "If what you say is true, then it is all right for you, my son, to keep it for your family." "Thank you, priest," and Brian hurried off. When the confession was over, the priest returned to his residence. When he walked into the kitchen, he found that someone had stolen his turkey. Yes. Irony. There's lots of it out there. Lots of irony. Well, how many here have ever attended a barbershop quartet concert? My wife and I go to them. We used to go to them more regularly. It's a cappella. Got four guys, usually singing bass, baritone, second, first tenor, something like that. Sometimes they have a melody in there. They change it a little bit. But anyway, close harmony, a lot of fun. Usually some of the guys cut up, usually have the best, you know, the championship, etc. Now, after the concert, for those who have gone, you'll probably recall us, they have something called an afterglow. The afterglow is when they take off and go to a local establishment that serves a few adult beverages, and then some of the people, they're invited to go over, and they'll sing a few more songs. And kind of, like I said, it's an afterglow, which is kind of a warm, comforting kind of thought. You think, okay, we're sitting by the fireplace and, you know, singing a few songs and stuff. It's kind of a nice deal. So I always liked the afterglow. One of these years we're going to go to one. I don't think we've ever been to one, but the thought sounded good. So anyway, what I decided to do this year, for this sermon, I was working on a sermon, and I didn't get it done. One of those idiot things. But I decided the sermon I gave at the feast is kind of a sermon for all seasons. I thought, well, people probably aren't going to listen, maybe one or two, heard me speak before at the feast. But anyway, I thought the sermon I gave at Lake Junaluska this year. And like I said, I think the principles and the lessons are for any time. Like I said, I think it's a sermon for all seasons. So here goes. Put yourself back. I mean, it isn't that long since the feast, and we're kind of almost in an afterglow period. Let me ask this. How many had a good feast this year? If it was a really good feast, raise both hands. If you got a foot, you can get that in there too. I would have to say it was one of the finest, if not the finest, feast I've ever been to. Lake Junaluska, probably never heard of the place. It's on the east side of the Smoky Mountains across from Gatlinburg, where we usually have it, or Sevierville, one of those places. Not far from Asheville. Gorgeous area. It's a beautiful little lake, mountains all around it, about 3,500 feet. It was glorious. And the messages this year, sermonettes, sermons, as fine as I've ever heard. And I even noticed this year, probably more than any time I ever remember, the opening and closing prayers. Gentlemen, a lot of times, probably not ordained, came up eloquent. You just see God's Spirit just, you know, poured down in buckets and barrels. So anyway, it was a wonderful feast. So it's kind of an afterglow. We're not that far away. So put yourself back into feast afterglow experience here, or mindset. As we look back through time and the broad sweep of history, and then forward to a day 1,000 years into the future, we're left with one inescapable conclusion. A perfect government, a perfect environment, coupled with perfect leadership, do not always guarantee a perfect outcome or result. Kind of startling to contemplate, is it? Isn't it? But it's true. History, both past and future, provide us with three startling examples. There might even be more. These are the three that came to my mind. Of this, you might say, mind-bending phenomena. Lucifer and the demonic third. The Garden of Eden and the snake episode. And the Gog and Magog 2, Four Corners, Gang of Revelation 20, verse 8. All with perfect government, perfect environment, and perfect leadership. Now, what does this almost surreal trio of events have to say about the 1,000 years of perfect environment, government, and leadership that we picture every year at the wonderful Feast of Tabernacles? And it's not a downer. I had to tell people that. Because it is a fabulous time of the year. It's a time we look forward to because what it pictures. And even though we'll be as spirit beings, we can still celebrate as physical human beings this wonderful time for everybody else. And of course, as spirit beings, there's no reason we can't celebrate as well. I mean, like David said, I'd rather be a doorman in the kingdom than a king on earth. So it is a fabulous time with incredible mind pictures. The theater of the mind that goes on during the feast is unlike any other time of the year for 99.99% of the world. We have been privileged, you and I, to come in to that theater of God when He portrays for us what it's going to be like for the next 1,000 years, or actually 1,100 if you go to the White Throne Judgment, and beyond that into eternity. So does this scenario somehow challenge the thought that those who live over into this magnificent period, from the heart-rending ravages, the international shock of Armageddon that is going to affect the entire world, and that those who are born and grow up, live on over, and those that are converted during the 1,000-year reign, they somehow get off light in their spiritual growing up process? The spiritual 548 maturation. That does appear that all it takes is a short cameo appearance by Satan as we see in Revelation 20, is able to deeply influence and deceive a sizable portion of the population. It says, as the sands of the seashore. It's not a small little group, a little cult off in the corner that kind of gets some big ideas, a better idea. This is from the sands, like the sands of the seashore, from the four corners of the earth. So it's a symbolic, metaphorical Gog and Magog, unlike the geographical one at the beginning of the millennium. And what about the parents? This is the one I like to think about and still blows my mind. The parents and grandparents who are either physically alive or have just been changed into spirit beings of that last generation or two. As they watch the unthinkable, we've had 1,000 years to teach and train. And the billions that will grow up in the millennium and be changed and surround us as the first fruits and helping prepare that last generation. And it still happens. With perfect government, perfect environment, and perfect leadership. It's kind of almost unthinkable. Like I said, surreal, bizarre, mind-blowing. No, there's much to ponder in this surreal scenario as we think about and consider our preparation as kings and priests for this assignment in eternity. And all those little things that Mr. Pischke talked about that we do day in and day out, they matter. They're important to God. All that stuff counts. So let's step back into paradise for a moment. It's a time of lions and lambs. Every one of us think about this great petting zoo that's going to be the world tomorrow, and it will be. A grand petting zoo. You know, everybody wants to grab a lion by the mane and, you know, put your nose to nose with a lion and get the old dog lick, you know, like your dog does. Your dog will do that. How would you think about a lion doing that or a tiger? You know, wouldn't that be fun? Blooming deserts. You know, granddaughter was down in the Atacama. She was in, how many here been to the Atacama? It's in Chile, in part of Peru. It's the driest place on the earth, almost no rain. Not a very pretty place. Got some strange stuff down there. I think maybe aliens came down and left some, you know, communications. So they're going to be blooming deserts. Everything's going to be gorgeous. After all, you figure, in the Great White Throne Judgment, estimates 25 to 50, maybe even up as many as 100 billion people, demographers taking a shot at it. We've got to get the world ready. We've got about 7.5 right now. If we've got 50, you know, I mean, that's 7 times. If it's 100, it's going to be about 14 times. We've got to get that land ready, you know. So those folks are going to live 100 years. They've got to have food and shelter and... So that's going to be one of the jobs in the world tomorrow, certainly, is prepping. So we've got those blooming deserts and all things utopian. Why, it's an age when 70-plus-year-old guys like me are able to program their DVRs. When TV commercials will not, and I repeat, will not exceed their programming in length or volume, especially at the end. And ah, yes, that great Scandahoovian entertainment team, Sven and Oli and all, will join Rodney Dangerfield in getting, finally, some respect. Yeah, sure, you betcha. Now we're talking real paradise here. Everybody gets along, no relationship problems. Why even the animals like each other? Life's going to be a proverbial breeze, right? Yeah, it's going to be good. It's going to be fabulous. Almost no bumps in the road. Very few lumps of life that we experience that I'll tell you more about that made me an idiot, just like Mr. Fischke. Things that we all do. Save that for later. Yeah, it's going to be great. Not going to be much of that stuff, right? Well, almost. It's going to be wonderful. As we picture each year at our great spiritual family reunion to get together around the world. It's a fabulous time. We know the scriptures are replete with magical pictures. We've painted already this time, we look forward to. But totally lump and bump free, sometimes we tend to think of that. We get this utopian thing going, like the communists always thought. Now, comrade, do you make this 10-year program, things are going to work good. You know, yeah. It's not quite like that. So we'll see. So, what will this great spiritual adjustment period be like for us? For the great remnant of mankind that are still in global shock, as I mentioned, from World War III, the really big one, Armageddon. Can you picture what the world's going to be like after the seven trumpet plagues and all that stuff that we read about in prophecy after the Feast of Trumpets? As spirit beings, we're going to have quite a different perspective. One actually not shared by the rest of the mankind, as we'll see. And, of course, you can picture that, at least for a while. It might take quite a while, actually. Now, one of the first glimpses we get of this day's fulfillment on the other side of C2C, Christ's second coming, is found in Zechariah. So let's just slip back there. I think almost every year we at least get into Zechariah 14 for just a second or two, a couple of scriptures. I'm going to hit a couple that we don't usually read, but let's start in verse 1. I'm reading from the New International Version. We know this is the time of Christ's return, even the heading of chapter 14 says that. It says, "The day of the Lord is coming, when your plunder will be divided among you. And I will gather all nations to Jerusalem to fight against it, and the city will be captured, and the houses ransacked, and the women raped, and half the city will go into exile, but the rest of the people will not be taken from the city. And then the Lord will go out and fight against these nations as they fight in the day of the battle." Sounds like the Feast of Trumpets, doesn't it? "And on that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives in East Jerusalem, and the Mount of Olives will be split in two from east to west, forming a great valley with half the mountain moving north and the other half south." Over to verse 8. It says, "On that day, living water will flow out from Jerusalem, and half to the eastern sea, half to the western sea, in summer and in winter. And the Lord will be king over the whole world, and on that day there will be one Lord in his name, the only name." So what we might see here is the initial transition from pre-C2C, before Christ comes, to post. Post-Armageddon. Let's pick it up in verse 16. This is where we usually read. "When the survivors from all the nations that have attacked Jerusalem will go up year after year to worship the King, the Lord Almighty, and to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles." You know, it's going to be a glorious time. You picture the whole world coming up. But, he says, "If." No, wait a minute. There aren't going to be any ifs, right? Christ is going to be back. You've got the angelic army of billions. You've got us, hundreds of thousands, maybe a few millions together. I mean, that's going to be quite a crew. It says, "If." "If any of the peoples of the earth do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, Lord Almighty, they will have no rain." Wait a minute. This is New Testament. That's right. 2 Thessalonians, New Testament. Apostle Paul, 20 to 30 years after Christ. "You don't eat, you don't work. You don't work, you don't eat." A little different picture, even in the millennium. God's way is quite a bit different than what we see around us, isn't it? Talks about a rod of iron. There has to be discipline. Does everything decently in order. And he says of the Egyptian peoples, if they don't go up and take part, and they're right next door, they'll have no rain. Now you think, okay, you got the Nile. If you don't have any rain, though, the Nile could dry up and then, you know. "The Lord will bring on them the plague he inflicts on the nations that don't go up to celebrate." So we're going to have no rain, we're going to have drought, we're going to have plagues. It's a nice start, isn't it? And this is next door. This is not 2,000, 4,000, 6,000, 8,000 miles away to the northwest, the northeast, the southwest, or the southeast of Jerusalem. Or 12,000, halfway around the world. This is next door. This will be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that are going up to celebrate. Well, that's a great way to start off the feast, isn't it? Sounds kind of like a downer, doesn't it? It really isn't when you get the whole picture. So this is the classic beginning of the millennium we've read about. You might say it's the conclusion to observing the birth and toddler years of the millennium and kingdom of God through the eyes of Zechariah. You know, when you're little guys, and the kids are running all over the place, and you're about ready to run out in the street and get hit by a car, that discipline has to kick in. And so God is doing some spanking here early on to get their attention. Now, back up just a second. The earth's going to be roughly 8 billion people before Armageddon. After, including the signs, seals, etc. It's going to be about half that. So they're going to watch 4 billion people die, which is 20 to 50 times all the major military battles in history. And then you throw on the 7 trumpet plagues that destroy everything that's green or drinkable across the whole planet. In waves. And they don't want to come up and get on with the program? To me, the Feast of Trumpets represents one thing more than anything else, besides the wonderful return of Christ and our change. The absolute strength of the human will to resist in the face of incredible, absolutely incredible, mind-blowing experiences. It's hard to believe. I sit through trumpets every year and I say, how? I'm a chicken. I'm not the guy that wants to be on the front of the phalanx in war, like the berserkers from Scandinavia or the Scots-Irish. In the British Army, some of the time. I'm not built that way. I'm an explorer. I'm not a fighter. So this is what we got going on. So you might say that spiritual child rearing is a bit messy at times. Just ask God, right? Through 6,000 years. And even through the millennium, as we're going to see. There's going to be some challenges. By the way, if you want titles, the title of the sermon is The Millennial Challenge. And this is for even for the best parents in the universe. How good a parent is God compared to us? I mean, we get through this. But you look at the chaos he allows. 6,000 years of chaos. People have children everywhere. They can't take care of them. You know, all the stuff that happens. The kids, that's God's kids. And he's allowing his heritage be reared by us as imperfect and sometimes unattentive and uncaring parents as we are over that 6,000 years. It's amazing. Stuff's mind-blowing. So it takes time, and it may take a lot of it, as we'll see, as the kingdom of God is set up in the gospel of God's wise and benevolent government, gradually flows out like that new Jerusalem river to bring refreshing life to a shocked and decimated world. Like I said, 4 billion people. We lost 100 million in World War II. WW2, the big one, greatest war of all time, 100 million. That's 40, 1/40, or you might say this would be 40 times roughly. Get your mind around that. All right. So how long is it going to take for the planet to look like the utopian descriptions of the classic millennial scriptures we always read, Isaiah 2 and 11, with all the cute little fuzzy critters that are getting along and, you know, all that stuff, the desert's blooming, all those things. How long? Let's see if God's time machine pilots can give us some clues. Let's fly with Ezekiel today. Hop on Ezekiel's time machine and go back to 38. It's not a chapter we read an awful lot. Sometimes get into 37, the dry bones, about Israel coming up and, you know, and Great White Throne Judgment. But 38 and 39. Now, this is a prophecy labeled against Gog. Turn to 38, verse 10. We'll just pick up a little bit. I'm not going to read a lot of it. I'm going to ask a couple questions with everything we've just mentioned. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. On that day, thoughts will come into your mind. Now, the setting here is the millennium, and we'll see in just a moment. It is the millennium. It's not before C2C and Armageddon. On that day, thoughts will come into your mind, and you will devise an evil scheme. Now, wait a minute. Assume with me, this is the millennium. Satan's in the pokey, the spiritual pokey, for 1,000 years. Nobody around. You will say, I will invade a land of unwalled villages, and I will attack a peaceful, unsuspecting people, all of them living without walls, without gates and bars. And I will plunder and loot and turn my hand against the resettled ruins of the people gathered from the nations, rich in livestock and goods, living at the center of the land. Now, where's the center of the land from the Bible standpoint? Jerusalem. So this is the rebuilt Israel that's going to be brought back in the second captivity, from the second captivity. We see in places like Jeremiah 30 and through there. So they're brought back. They're living for a while. They've already developed wealth. So they've cleaned up this land, and we read about how it's going to take 7 months to, you know, bury them, and, you know, and they're going to use firewood for 7 years or whatever it is from all the, you know, the weapons, etc. So here we see these guys come down. So they've already rebuilt things. They've been gathered from the nations. How long is that going to take? How long is it going to take to create cities and the farmland? Remember what happened in the seven trumpets. Land's decimated. Now, it is interesting. I've been to Hiroshima. How many of you have been to Hiroshima, Japan? All right. I've been through the Holocaust, their Holocaust Museum. And it's remarkable. Everybody thought after that atomic bomb was dropped, it would take years and years for the land to come back. You know how long it took for the first green blades to come forth? Less than 6 months. They were starting to recover. Today, Hiroshima is a beautiful city. It's totally rebuilt. My daughter was teaching a little ways from there, about an hour and a half out, a little bitty town. So we got a chance to go there and see it. Totally rebuilt. Beautiful. But it had come back. Incredibly. And that's atomic warfare. Of course, there'll probably be some of that. So we see here these unwalled cities. Now ask the question. Since 1948, okay, that's almost 70 years, right? How many times have the Israelis lived in walled cities at peace, unwalled cities at peace? Let's see, in 48, they just got in, picked up the newspaper off the front porch, got the groceries from the store, first war. I was over there in 1970. I've told you this story before. 3 years after Six-Day War, 3 years before the Yom Kippur War. There were soldiers running around Jerusalem, walking around Jerusalem, AK-47s. They got their had their camos on. They weren't totally pervasive, but you saw them. And I went up to the Sea of Galilee and took a tour in northern Israel. Beautiful area. Hula Lake, saw the source of the Jordan River. And after a hot day, swam in the Sea of Galilee, which is a lot, I was thinking, it looks like Lake Coronas. We used to have a cabin up there. Typical Minnesota lake, it's about 12 by 6, shaped like a pear. A high place in the northeast. And so we swam and sat down as the sun went down. I'm laying there in a chaise lounge with the rest of the students, and we're looking out, and I'm thinking, you know, this reminds me a lot of Minnesota in the middle of the summer, around 4th of July. Hey, guys, how about a fireworks? And we look over to this northeast corner of the lake, and all of a sudden, fireworks. Except it wasn't fireworks. It was the real thing. These were tracer bullets from the Golan Heights as the Syrians were bombarding the Israelis, and they were going back and forth. And I'm 7 miles, as the crow flies roughly, from real war. Close as I've been. So we can see here the Israelis have not exactly had unwalled cities in peace for the last 7 years, have they? And they aren't going to have any in the near future either. They're gearing up for war right now again. So this is not talking about anything leading up to Armageddon. It's after. This is the millennium. And you've got folks here called Gog. Now, this is a geographical Gog. That's up into Central Asia. It might go up as far as into Russia and Kazakhstan and all the stands. And probably, you know, north could go northeast up into, you know, Afghanistan and those areas. And so we see these guys coming down there. How long did it take for Israel to set up and get to the point of wealth? And compare that with Zechariah. You still got Egypt and, you know, the Arab nations around. How long is it going to take them? It could take decades. We don't tend to think of that, do we? Our BRP, as we used to call it, the Bible Reading Program, now our excellent church commentary. Just saw Tom Robinson down at the regional conference, and he's going to be getting cranked up. He's still got a little work to do in the Old Testament, and then he's going to get on the New Testament. Been pretty busy lately. It's a wonderful commentary. He said an interesting note in verse 10. It says, an evil thought comes from Gog and Magog's mind. Like I said, where'd that come from? Satan's gone. He's in Old Bailey, as they say in Britain. Kind of hard to fathom this stuff could happen, isn't it? In a perfect environment, perfect government, and perfect leaders. So what does it say about our job in the millennium specifically, and about spiritual child rearing in general? What God's trying to do over the last 6,000 years, what he's going to be doing in the millennium? You might say, the seas of social political change could be a bit rough for a while, even in the wonderful world tomorrow. Even with the King of Kings at helm. So how could this be? Let's visit Isaiah for a moment. Turn over to chapter 30. Isaiah is the utopian or the millennial prophet. Probably has more to say than any other of God's foretellers. Chapter 30, verse 19. Very interesting couple of scriptures. This once again is a millennial setting, chapter 30 and several of the chapters around. So here we are in 19. It says, O people of Zion, who live in Jerusalem. Now this is projecting into that period of time in the millennium, and you can read around it, the context, and we'll see that. It says, you will weep no more. So kind of go back to Ezekiel 38, unwalled cities, living at peace, wealthy, obeying God's laws, brought back from captivity. Okay. You'll weep no more. How gracious he will be when you cry for help. As soon as he hears, he will answer. And although the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, your teachers will be hidden no more. With your own eyes you will see them. That's us. Could be angels. depending on how God sorts out the responsibilities. We don't see angels now, except once in a while, one unawares maybe. We don't see the spirit world. It says then they will. They're going to see us. And whether you turn to the right or to the left, your ears will hear a voice behind you saying, this is the way, walk you in it. And then you, goes on to tell what they're going to do. But just these couple of scriptures. It says, if you ask, now wait a minute, rod of iron? I don't think exactly what's being described here. Though the Lord gives you adversity, and suffering is the New Living Translation, suffering, or affliction as I just read from the NIV. And note this is not time-based or restricted. It could happen any time throughout the millennium. It doesn't say it's the first 50 years, 100 years, 500, 700, 1,000. It's talking about a program, an approach, the way God's servants, who will be the teachers, the mentors, spiritual mentors, during this period of time, and how they're going to operate. And you'll notice something very interesting. No spiritual arm twisting, does it? A strong teaching emphasis. If you ask, this is the way, walk you in it. Walk you in it. I'm not going to grab them and throw them back on the road. However, there are consequences too. Ultimately, and especially to get the nations into the program we just read in Zechariah 14. It appears kind of that Isaiah 30 addresses more of the personal program. After national acceptance, it appears, you start to work in closely with people. Though God, we know, can work with people anytime. Maybe the nation hasn't decided to come down, but they're individuals that say, God, you know, I've seen enough. I've been through Armageddon. I've read the book now, I've taken it up, and I see what happened, just like some people did as they left Egypt with Israel. Remember? It was a great following of proselytes that had seen the light of those 10 plagues and saw Pharaoh humbled. They got the picture. And they chose to go with Israel. So there could be some. So if we really delve into these millennial scriptures and try to picture and understand what this fabulous time, once again, it is a fabulous time, will really be like, and what our job responsibilities will entail, we must conclude there are going to be some challenges. There are going to be some lumps along the way. And not during just the post-Armageddon transition that we read of Zechariah 14, Ezekiel 38, but throughout the 1,000 years. And right up to the Great White Throne Judgment, and I submit all the way through the Great White Throne Judgment. The Great White Throne Judgment won't be different in principle than the millennium. Anything in the Bible, it tells me. Same program. God's rearing children, got to do the same stuff. All we're doing, we've got 1,000 years to get the world ready for that incredible horde that will be coming up. So let's learn about, as we look at our job and what we're going to have to do, considering all these things, some of the challenges that face ahead. You know, God has, you know, got to get us ready. And a lot of life is about that. So we're going to learn a little bit this afternoon about what I call spiritual lumpology, preparation for our vital kingdom responsibilities, from a man who had a PhD in it. His name was Mr. Sigmund Wolman. And what I'd like to do is quote from a Reader's Digest article some years ago called Sigmund Wolman's Reality Test. And it came from a book called Uh-Oh by Mr. Robert Fulghum. He was of All I Know I Learned in Kindergarten fame. Kind of character, and wrote some kind of fun stuff. We're going to set this all up, though, through the eyes of Mr. Sigmund Wolman and his reality test. So we've got a lot of reality to deal with in the world tomorrow. It was the summer of 1959 at a resort inn in the Sierra Nevadas of Northern California. And I had a job that combined being the night desk clerk in a lodge and helping with the horse wrangling in the stables. The owner-manager was Swiss, with European notions about conditions of employment. He and I did not get along. I thought he was a fascist who wanted peasant employees who knew their place. And I was 22, just out of college, and pretty free with my opinions. One week, the employees had been served the same thing for lunch every single day. Two wieners, mound of sauerkraut. And stale rolls. To compound insult with injury, the cost of the meals were deducted from our paychecks. I was outraged. On Friday night of that awful week, I was at my desk job around 11 p.m., and the night auditor had just come on duty. I went into the kitchen and saw a note to the chef to the effect that wieners and sauerkraut were on the employee menu for two more days. Well, that tore it. For lack of any better audience, I unloaded on the night auditor, Sig Wolman. I declared that I'd had it up to here, and I was going to get a plate of wieners and sauerkraut and wake up the owner and throw it at him. And nobody was going to make me eat wieners and sauerkraut for a whole week and make me pay for it, and this was un-American, and I didn't like wieners and sauerkraut enough to eat them one day, and the whole hotel stunk, and I was packing my bags and heading for Montana when they never even heard of wieners and sauerkraut and wouldn't feed this stuff to pigs. Something like that. I raved on this wave for 20 minutes. My monologue was delivered at the top of my lungs, punctuated by blows on the front desk with a fly swatter, the kicking of chairs, and much profanity. As I pitched my fit, Sig Wolman sat quietly on his stool, watching me with sorrowful eyes. Put a bloodhound in a suit, and you have Sig Wolman. He had good reason to look sorrowful. Survivor of Auschwitz. 3 years. German Jew. Thin. Coughed a lot. He liked being alone at the night job. They gave him intellectual space, peace, and quiet. And ever more, even more, he could go into the kitchen and have a snack whenever he wanted to. All the wieners and sauerkraut he wished. To him, it was a feast. More than that, there was nobody around to tell him what to do. In Auschwitz, he had dreamed of such a time. And the only person he saw at work was me, the mighty disturber of his dream. Our shifts overlapped an hour, and there I was, a one-man war party at full cry. Listen, Forgem! Listen me! Listen me! You know what's wrong with you? It's not the Venus and the Kraut. It's not the boss. It's not the chef. It's not the job. So what's wrong with me? Forgem, you think you know everything. But you don't know the difference between inconvenience and a problem. And if you break your neck, if you have nothing to eat, if your house is on fire, then you got a problem. Everything else is inconvenience. Life is inconvenient. Life is lumpy. I think we could say that Sig knew some pretty big lumps. in his life. We'd all agree to that. And I think most people instinctively, intuitively, know the difference between most lumps. And even some have an inkling in how to deal with them. And yet, which of us isn't or hasn't been caught off guard, challenged emotionally and mentally in this area? Happens all the time, doesn't it? It's tough to keep it all in perspective now sometimes during the day. Today grind, the spiritual boot camp we call life. You see, we get the bread of adversity and the water of affliction. Or is it bread of affliction, water of adversity? I always get those mixed up. We got it just like they will in the world tomorrow. Plus, we get a bonus called Satan and his demons. So it's boot camp. The world tomorrow is going to have its own unique challenges, and we're going to be right in the middle of them and expected to know how to administer lump aid, perspective, how to handle the lumpy characters of life and what they're going through, and the lumpy episodes, dealing with the lumpy side of life. There's a lot of it. So let's visit a few in preparation for our Isaiah 30 assignments as providers of spiritual lump aid. Let's turn over to Luke chapter 13. Luke 13, verses 1 through 5. Now there were some present at the time who told Jesus about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. And Jesus answered, "Do you think these Galileans were worse sinners than all the other Galileans because they suffered this way? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you too will all perish. Or those 18 who died when the tower in Siloam fell on them, do you think they were more guilty than all the others living in Jerusalem? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you too will perish." Now, we read this. Now focus on the second part. Just a couple of lines. It's a footnote in history in a totally different context. That of repentance. But let's go back to that horrible day. Just the second part. The Tower of Siloam. I've walked around the walls of Jerusalem. And I was over there at the dig in 1970 before I went up to the Sea of Galilee for my swim and see the fireworks. I walked around that wall at night when the moon was out, and the beautiful dry air in the evening when it cools off. It was warm during the day, but we survived, worked in the morning, studied in the afternoon. It was really pretty. It was spectacular to think that this was the area that Christ walked in, the disciples. But let's think of it in terms of the families. As many as 18, depending on how. It could have been husbands, wives, but maybe it was just a bunch of guys or a bunch of gals. Doesn't say. Doesn't give us a lot of details. But think of it this way. Here were 18 people out for an evening stroll in this beautiful area. And of course, at that time, it was spectacular. Herod had refurbished the temple. The walls were still in good shape. Here we are, been over this. The walls are still pretty good 2,000 years later. They built stuff well. Who knows what they were doing? They were just out for a stroll. I went to a light show in that area, and, it was pretty, and it was romantic. It was a nice evening. Who knows what they were talking about? I mean, they were talking politics like people do now, You had old Herod, maybe they were talking about, they didn't have a democracy back then, the next election or anything coming up, but, they could have been talking about that stuff. The Tower of Siloam could have been a fortification in the outer wall near the Pool of Siloam. History doesn't really say, archaeologists don't really know. Possibly an aqueduct built by Pilate, some surmise. Little is known, but this we do know. 18 families were sent into shock that fateful day. And expand how many families. They had large families back then. If it were individuals representing families, multiply it out. If their wives and children and uncles and aunts and grandparents and relatives and friends. It could have been hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands that knew these people. Quite possibly. It was kind of like the Mura building of Oklahoma City or the Twin Towers of New York City, 9/11/2001. Mura building, it's hard to believe, 1995, a long time ago. How about San Bernardino, Orlando, now Las Vegas, and on it goes. Let's put this into perspective for that city and country. Jerusalem and Judea of Christ's day was a country about the same size as Israel is today, about 7 to 8 million people, maybe a little smaller. United States today is about 3.25 million, almost a third of a billion, pretty big country. So we're about 50 times the size of Judea in Christ's time. So if you were to make the comparison, how many would have died today in that little incident of 18? Doesn't sound like a lot of people. Bring it to the United States, that'd be 1,000 people. 4 times the Mira building. 1/3 of the mother of all terrorist events. 9/11. Pretty big lump. Big lump to all these relatives. Just out for a night walk in a beautiful Judean evening. And bang. Gone. And Christ's comment. These weren't the worst people. Average. It's like us. No great wretchedness of life. Could this happen in the millennium? Yes. Just ask the innocent women and children and elderly of the families of the leaders and the armies of the millennial Gog and Magog as you read down the rest of 38 and what God is going to do to them as they come down and attack peaceful Israel. Now finally, after 2,500 years, has become the showcase nation that God always wanted. But old Gog's coming down there. He's going to get some booty. And it's not going to be pretty as you read the rest of that. What about their families up there? This is in the millennium. Not once, but twice. Once at the beginning, which I just referred to, and then once at the end. I won't go into that, but that creates all kinds of scenarios. Women, children, and stubborn men and leaders, putting families through drought and famine and battle, rather than go to the feast, or because they look out, because an evil thought comes to their mind, and the devil ain't around. You can't claim that the devil made me do it anymore. Sorry, Flip Wilson, you're out of the picture. You and Geraldine, bye-bye. A lot of people think, yeah, the devil made me. They blame everything on Satan. None of that. Satan's not around. All this happens with the King of Kings at the head. So could this happen during the millennium? Yeah. Maybe not the time and chance circumstances of the Tower of Siloam, what it appears to be. But big millennial problems, not inconveniences for the surviving families, that's for sure. I don't know how Isaiah 30's twin spiritual challenges of the bread of affliction and water of adversity will take us after such a transition happens during those first years that we just read about. But certainly, there's going to be stuff going on. It's going to happen by their choice. Because you see, we're all free moral agents. And God can no longer or more twist arms in the millennium than he did for the last 6,000 years. We have to want it. We have to seek it. We have to buy into it and have to be persuaded. Like it says about Abraham, in Romans 4. He was fully persuaded. We have to love the truth unto death, and believe me, we are coming up against it within a few decades here, the way it appears. And we are going to be challenged by Matthew 24:24. By the greatest scam in the universe. The great lie of 2 Thessalonians 2. And it says the whole world is going to worship the beast and the false prophet. How's that happen? Well, I preached a sermon that's known as the Pope's Sermon, but it goes into what Satan is going to do. Well, there's no Satan here. There's a lot of stuff. Okay. Spiritual child ring can be messy. Human beings are still stubborn. You see that? I just read in Ezekiel 38, right after the millennium. Christ is here, got everything starting to go. I mean, how long did it take for Israel to build up? And these guys are coming down? You know? All right. Let's look at the other side of Sig's reality tests. Let's go back to Luke again, chapter 10 this time, a couple chapters back. This is more the oatmeal variety lump. Chapter 10, verse 38, you know the story. It's the story of Martha and Mary. I'm not going to read it because you know it so well. Here we find Martha's lump as kind of a no mince on the pillow at the Motel 6. A waitress is a bit tardy or inattentive at the Cracker Barrel. Or maybe you ended up with a neighbor's phone bill and he's got primetime relatives in Zanzibar or Timbuktu. You know, now you don't have to pay for it, but you get the idea. It's an irritation. It's a lot of irritations. Modified road rage. Now, Martha was put out, wasn't she? But was she really put upon? Maybe a little, yeah. Somebody had to do the housework. Get the meal ready, do all those things. Sure, it was a bit inconvenient. But after all, what is a little housework compared to sitting at the feet of the being? Taught up close and personal, the very creator of the universe. How many chances have you had to do that? Well, in a sense, we all have when we pray. But how about personally? Flesh and blood. The creator of the universe who lived back ever in eternity with the Father. The Word. That did all this stuff. Created the universe. Came down in flesh. And you can sit down and talk to Him just like we talk to each other. He was a common man. Says that. The average folks like us liked him. Not only the Pharisees had a problem with him. The rest of everybody liked him. No contest, right? Take that option, that opportunity every time. Perspective, perspective, perspective. It's reality time, as Sig said. Time to keep the mintless pillows of life, the small lumps of our sojourn, in their proper place emotionally. It's good prep work for minor lump aid in the world tomorrow, as well as the major lump aid we talked about. And I'm sure we're going to have some at the feast. And I mentioned that. Mr. Pishke mentioned how we all get to be idiots. Well, I played the idiot. It seemed like every feast we get a couple of these. We couldn't find our house at the feast. This beautiful paradise known as Lake Junaluska. It was millennial. We couldn't find our house. We checked in and got the keys, and we drove around and checked houses, what we thought, and we were in the ball period, tried to use algebra and narrow it down, okay. We couldn't find the place. So finally we picked up, Mr. Kubik was there, and he was early, and we were going to go do some stuff, so we picked up and drove by the house. He says, oh, there's a sign in the middle of the yard. Now, it wasn't a very big sign, but it was still there with the address on it. We're looking for the mailbox. We're looking on the... I went up to the house, looked at all the houses. They didn't have numbers on them. Some of them did. Some did, and kind of narrowed it down. We didn't see the sign. Anyway, that's how we started off our feast, but got a lot better after that. It was of a little lump. Irritation, yeah. Not a biggie. Okay, finally, let's turn back one more chapter. Seems like Luke is the guy today. Chapter 9, verse 51. This is another lump of a different kind. Maybe more in the middle. Definitely not a big one. And here we get a chance to see how our spiritual big brother handled a minor league lump. I'd like to read from an expanded paraphrase of this episode, you might say, of Christ University of the Road. It's from a book called The Man Nobody Knows, by Bruce Barton, chapter 1. It's called The Leader. It was very late in the afternoon, and if you'd like to learn the measure of a man, that is the time of day to watch him. We're all half an inch taller in the morning than at night, and it's fairly easy to take a large view of things when the mind is rested and the nerves are calm. But a day is a steady drain of small annoyances, and the difference in the size of the man becomes hourly more important or apparent. The little man loses his temper. The big man takes a firmer hold. It was very late in the afternoon in Galilee. The dozen men had walked all day over the dusty, hot roads, and they were tired. And the sight of the village was very cheering as they looked down on it from the top of a little hill. Their leader, deciding that they had gone far enough, sent two members of the party ahead to arrange accommodations, while he and the others sat down by the roadside to wait. After a bit, the messengers were seen returning, and even at a distance, it was apparent that something unpleasant had occurred. Their cheeks were flushed, their voices angry, and as they came nearer, they quickened their pace, each wanting to be the first to explode the bad news. Breathless, they told, the people in the village had refused to receive them, had given them blunt notice to seek shelter elsewhere. The indignation of the messengers communicated itself to the others, who at first could hardly believe their ears. This backwards village refused to entertain their master. It was unthinkable. He was a famous public figure in that part of the world. He had healed the sick, given freely to the poor. In the capital city, crowds had followed him enthusiastically, so that even the disciples had become men of importance, looked up to, talked about. And now to have this country village deny them admittance as its guests? Lord! These people are insufferable, one of them cried. Let us call down fire from heaven and consume them. The others joined in with enthusiasm. Fire from heaven, that was the idea. Make them smart for their boorishness. Show them they can't afford to affront us with impunity. Come, Lord, the fire. There are times when nothing man can say is nearly so powerful as saying nothing. A business executive can understand that. To argue brings him down to the level of those with whom he argues. Silence convicts them of their folly. They wish they had not spoken so quickly. They wonder what he thinks. The lips of Jesus tightened. His fine features showed the strain of the preceding weeks. In his eyes, they foreshadowed the more bitter weeks to come. He needed that night's rest, but he said not a word. Quietly, he gathered up his garments and started on, his outraged companions following. It's easy to imagine his keen disappointment. He'd been working with them for 3 years. Would they never catch a true vision of what he was, what he was trying to do? He had so little time, and they were constantly wasting it. They wanted him to gratify his personal resentment by burning up a village. Down the hot road, they trailed after him, awed by his silence, vaguely conscious they had failed again to measure up. And they went to another village, says the narrative, nothing more. No debate, no bitterness, no futile conversation. In the mind of Jesus, the thing was too small for comment. In a world where so much must be done and done quickly, memory cannot afford to be burdened with petty slights. And they went on to another village. Small lump. Very small lump. So here we see a powerful statement by the trainer of trainers, the mentor of mentors, on how to handle the lumps of the throat and those in the oatmeal. And there will be many of this kind in the millennium, just like today. Just ask Barnabas and Paul. Let's finish up with a little more SIG. Just a couple of comments. Oh, I know it's here. There it is. Small one. Fulcham, learn to separate the inconvenient from the real problems. You will live longer. It will not annoy people like me so much. Good night. In a gesture combining dismissal and blessing, he waved me off to bed. Seldom in my life have I been hit between the eyes so hard with truth. There in that late night darkness of a Sierra Nevada inn, Sigmund Wolman simultaneously kicked my butt and opened a window to my mind. For 30 years now, in times of stress and strain, when something has me backed against the wall, and I'm ready to do something really stupid with my anger, a sorrowful face appears in my mind and asks, Fulcham, problem or inconvenience? I think of this as the Wolman test of reality. Life is lumpy. And a lump in the oatmeal and a lump in the throat and a lump in the breast are not the same lump. One should learn the difference. One should learn the difference. You see, God gives us the ultimate freedom. The Deuteronomy 30:19, freedom of choice. It is the freedom to meet the lumps of life on their own terms and make choices that, with the help of the Holy Spirit, will help us and others grow into the Matthew 5:48 spiritual mature divine nature. And in the process, we become truly more godlike. The Feast of Tabernacles is a spiritual showcase time. We all understand that. It's ambassador time before the world, in a sense. Though the other 355 or so days of the year certainly are as well. Every day is important in the life of a Christian. All the small things. Because you see, life, just like Mr. Pishke meant, are made up of a lot of little things. And a lot of little lumps. I think Sig Wolman's tests can help us now. We're going to have a few lumps, I'm sure, this coming week. Like I said, maybe some had this last week. And learning about and handling the lumps of life is just about job one for Christians. And preparing to help our potential brothers and sisters in the times these portray with their lumps that we just read. The world tomorrow. The millennial challenges. After all, life is lumpy. Just ask Sig. And spiritual child rearing is messy. Just ask God. And how we respond makes all the difference in the world. Now, tomorrow, and for eternity. Good night, Sig.